how much gets lost because we can't cry. You know, how much gets lost when we have to assume that the burden must rest on our shoulders alone. What are the costs of a certain kind of hyper-masculine pose? So, for me, what does it mean to be a good man? Is a question that I would throw, that I would have to revise. What does it mean to be a decent human being?
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode. So, I'm going to try something different. I always do this preamble before I start the show, and I just kind of throw in a bit of a brief description about the guest that I'm going to have a conversation with, and just kind of like freewheel and kind of get into the conversation. But I think I'm going to start having more kind of honest chats with you guys, just because I feel like my energy is just asking for that to happen. There's something that's just convicting me to just have these conversations with you. I mean, yes, I've got the Life Edit episodes that happen on Wednesdays, fortnightly. So the next one that's going to come up is going to be a really good one. I'm planning to have a really good discussion around masculinity and masculinities. And it'd be very interesting just to hear. It's for all people to listen to, because it's my particular stance is about the ideas around what that means, especially when it comes to inclusion. But what I'm about to say is just, it's really interesting, just the timing of things when these things happen. I have been watching the news, and I don't really like watching the news, just because it's not helpful for kind of my spirit and just generally where I'm at in life. You know, it just means every time I would watch it, I always leave the room angry, kissing my teeth, upset, kind of like, oh, this planet really gets on my nerves. And you know, I start to really doubt the nature of humanity and what that means for all of us. And when I sat down and I watched like these, I want to say white supremacist people storming the Capitol in the United States, and you know, led by their president, talking about you know, kind of really insurrecting discontent and getting them to rebel against the state and doing all this stuff. It just made me really think about how, just on a deeper level, there's something that we're just not connecting with. There's something that we're not connecting with out here, and it's really down to our collective humanities that are just not, there's something that's not aligning, and it kind of makes me feel sick, you know. I look at the world and I look at how each nation has a particular personality, but I've also looked at the world and I'm just thinking about each nation has a particular age. Now, I've been looking at soul ages for a long time and thinking, just been kind of really delving into what that means to have a soul age and where you're at with those soul ages. And when I look around the world, I look at America sometimes and I just think it's a really young country. It's acting as if, I wouldn't want to say a child, but it's acting very young, like an adolescent, like a teenager. Okay, so like a teenager who hasn't found its way yet, hasn't found their way yet. And you know, when they rebel, they want to go their own way. They, you know, we've all had those phases as teens. We don't want to be told what to do. We want to hang out with the cool kids. We want to, you know, pave a way for our own things ourselves. And I look at it and I just think to myself, like, America is really, really just not ready. And I don't say not ready as in, like, you know, there's some kind of big deadline or something that needs to be ready for. But I'm just looking at it and I'm thinking, you're not, something about it, they're not at an age level where they can actually cohesively and coherently lead a country. Like, that country is on the border of civil war. Like, it is discontent to the point where I can't even envisage myself going there to visit. Like, This is where people live. This is where people have made a life for themselves. This is where people, you know, open up their eyes when they're born. We don't choose any of this. We wake up and we're born, and we are thrust into the world. And when we're thrust into the world, we are thrown into all of these different conditions and circumstances, and we just don't know what that means. We could, you know, this. I'm doing a lot of conversation. I'm having a lot of conversations with myself, and a lot of learning and studying around soul work, and you know, our souls have chosen us to, and chosen the bodies that inhabit the soul, right? And you know, the soul has chosen for us to end up in white skin, black skin, you know, differently abled, queer, trans, all of these different things to enact a particular thing in this world. And when you open up your eyes and you're just in this space that is crumbling around you, your livelihood, everything, it just kind of makes me just think about the nature of where we go from here, where we go next. I have no idea. I know that I, as you all know who are listening to me, if you're new here, welcome. Amazing for you to come during this episode where I'm changing things up a little bit. But when we look at our past and our purposes and where we're going, and I know that I'm in the business of having healing conversations, I'm in the business of healing, I'm in the business of soul work, I'm in the business of, when I say business, I don't mean from a capitalistic point of view, but I'm talking about in what I'm concerned with. I'm concerned with the healing of people. I'm concerned with us moving from emotional stunting to emotional awareness. I'm in the school of thought that we all have a trauma or something that we need to work through and overcome and move through, you know? So that is where I'm at with it. It just made me feel discontent. And when I look around, and here in the UK, for any of the UK listeners, anybody who's remotely interested in what's going on over here, we see the government have a blatant assault on the poor and the lower income people. And I don't even like using the word poor. It's just the word that came to my mind because that's the word that's been conditioned and been programmed into me to use. But I want to say lower income, and I don't even want to say disadvantaged. It's just like lower income people, with the government, you know, paying. For those of you who don't know, it's we're on lockdown in this country, and there's no kids going back to school. And a vast majority of the country cannot afford to eat. So the government has had commissioned a company, I think they were called Chartwells, and to provide meals to families for 5 days worth £30 a week. So they provide shopping, and they send it, and they hand it to these families who are on this particular scheme. And some of the images that are going around on the internet are absurd. The pictures that these parents, predominantly mothers, are taking pictures of the food that was given to them, and the government and these companies are saying that that's worth £30. When you look at it, you think to yourself, that is not worth £30. You know what's worth £30. You know you can go out and you can sit down and you go to the shop. You know if you have £30, that will do you for a week, typically. If you need to buy on a budget, £30 will get you enough food. Probably won't get you the best quality brands. It probably won't get you so many treats or things that you probably don't need. But if you needed the basics, if you needed the pastas, breads, tinned foods, you know, complex carbs, if you needed some protein, if you needed those things, you could get that on £30, and you could kind of budget that for the week and do that. But the food that these people were getting were not even, it wasn't enough. And it was heartbreaking. It was heartbreaking. It's still heartbreaking to see. It took Marcus Rashford, football player in the UK, to tweet and speak to the Prime Minister to get that rectified, because he's been campaigning for a while, since the beginning of COVID, really, about school dinners and kind of making sure that kids get to eat, because when you're from a lower income family, it's not always possible to be able to eat, like, you know. And there's a city in the UK called Manchester, and I was watching the news again, and it was, they were talking about food banks and homeless shelters, and there was one woman on there, and she said, you know, it's a choice of whether I pay my mortgage or I eat. And, you know, she was like, I have to pay my mortgage, I don't want to be homeless, but I'm hungry. So all of these different things that's going on in the country because of COVID, because of Brexit that's happening, all of these different things. And it's just a lot. And it made me just really think about the kind of things that I want to be doing and kind of the way I want to be showing up in the world and how I want to show up in the world and why I want to show up in the way I do. And it does, you know, bring me onto this week's guest. And so, you know, like, as you know, I love to have these conversations. I want to make a difference. I want to make a change. And I think that if I come away from there with learning things, with nuggets, I just hope that you come away and you hear what I hear, or hear something different. And then tell me. I love when you guys message me when you hear something. So that leads me on to this week's guest. I've got an amazing conversation, and it's with Eddie S. Gloud Jr. And so Eddie is amazing. Eddie's fantastic. Like, just, I was blown away by this whole conversation that we had. Eddie's the author of a book called Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Today. I came across Eddie last year, and I saw a video of him on, I think he's been a commentator. He's an academic. He's a professor. He's a professor, and he works at, I want to say, he's at Princeton University, and he teaches there. And looking at that clip where he was saying, America is going to have to learn again and again and again. I'm paraphrasing exactly what he said, but he basically is saying, like, after all the Black Lives Matter protests, with everything that happened in July, and I think it was June, July, over last summer anyway, and he was like, America is going to have to feel these lessons again and again and again, because we're not learning the lessons again and again and again. And he's like, we have to begin again, because we're predicated on fear, on pain, on trauma, on destruction, and all these different things. And if we begin again, we can create a future. There's a theme building for the episodes that I'm coming from for these past two episodes, and about building legacy and rebuilding the future. I don't know where it's come from. It just feels really synergistic. I definitely made that word up. But yeah, we know Eddie and I, we speak about James Baldwin. We speak about the lessons that James Baldwin left in his legacy, and the things that we can learn from him, and how we can make the world better. He is obviously speaking from an American-centric point of view, because he is American. But we do nod about across the different things that are happening across the Atlantic, and it's fantastic. It's an amazing episode. I really enjoyed doing this episode. So, as ever, please rate, review, and subscribe. And do share the episode where you can. And guys, comment with me, connect with me, engage with me on Instagram. Listen, I'm there to be engaged with. Drop me messages if you like what is being said, if you don't like what's being said. If you have any suggestions for guests, tell me who you want to hear from. Tell me what you want to hear. Like, just drop me a message. Also, go to iTunes. I have to do this thing. Go to Apple Podcasts and rate, review on there. Just leave me a review, because the more I get seen, the more people I can get on. And we've got an amazing roster of guests coming this year. But the more we can get, and the better. And we need these conversations for today. We need these conversations. It's taken me so long to get to a stage where I know the kind of conversations I want to have. And we need these conversations. So, without further ado, Eddie Escalade Jr., welcome to Time to Talk. Welcome to Time to Talk, Eddie. Thank you so much for joining me.
It is my pleasure. I'm excited about the conversation.
So you're my first recording for 2021. So I put that in the bracket of start as we mean to go on. So there's no pressure there, but I'm looking forward to this conversation. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
I wanted to start with just congratulations on the book. I hear that it has been doing amazingly on the New York Times bestseller list so far. But before we get into that, the book is Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Today. Before we get into that, though, I wanted to ask a question around what memory do you have of your childhood that you hold on to today?
What memory do I have from my childhood that I hold on to today? Oh, they vary. Mm-hmm. And I suppose the most recent memory, because I've been writing about it, is being afraid of my dad, you know, having these scary encounters with him. And that varies from time to time. You know, it's a kind of the flitting memory of a stare, of a kind of glare that would freeze me in place. So in some ways, the memories have been kind of jumbled together as I try to untangle trauma in my own life as I write. So alongside that, I suppose, given that we just came out of the Christmas holidays, was that my mother loved Christmas, and we would have these amazing things on Christmas Eve. She would cook a pot of gumbo, and we would all open a present or two, and it would just be wonderful. So those are the kind of two things that would converge. And my dad would always act ignorantly on Christmas, during the Christmas holidays. So.
Was it hard kind of picking apart some of the things some of the topics in the book when it came to the memories of your father?
You know, in some ways, I had to do it. Baldwin insisted that I do it. And in order for me to have an authentic voice on the page, I had to be honest with myself. And Baldwin believes in the Socratic dictum that the unexamined life is not worth living. And so there's this demand that I knew about, but I didn't. And this is why I was kind of hesitant to write about him or to write with him, was that I knew he was going to ask something of me that I wasn't sure I was willing to answer. But as I was writing, I knew I had to deal with the fact that I'm a vulnerable little boy. And my dad deposited fear in my gut from an early age. And that I had to grapple with that. I had to confront that in order for my voice to be heard on the page. Otherwise, I would find myself just simply trying to imitate his sentences or trying to imitate Baldwin's voice as opposed to my own. And so the book is in some ways a result of that confrontation, of that willingness on my part to look those experiences with my father squarely in the face. Now, mind you, me and my dad are really close today, but that's a journey. That was a journey. It took a journey to get there.
So what was that becoming? Was it you growing into an adult man? Was it then you becoming a father that just built that connection up with you and your dad? Or
I think it's a couple of things. You know, so my dad and my mom were basically children, raising children. They were young. He had four kids, one of whom was severely handicapped, and my mother had me. I was the last one, and she was barely 21.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You see what I mean? Yeah. They were growing up with us in some ways. I grew up on the coast of Mississippi, Alex. And so and my family, my dad's side of the family is light skin, green eyes, and he's my color.
Okay.
So he grew up with colorism in his family. So I remember coming home from college. I went to Morehouse College in Atlanta. And I went home to, my mother insisted that I come home because she saw the relationship had deteriorated in so many ways. And he'd started telling me a story before I could even open my mouth. And it was in some ways an account of his trauma, you know, asking his dad, why am I so dark compared to others? And his dad telling him that I found you in the garbage can or something like that. So basically, I, you know, the short answer to your question is that I came to understand him better. So my judgment was less exacting. I came to see that, you know, here's a man who got up every morning and went to work, fixed the same sandwich every day, either a bologna sandwich with mustard and mayonnaise or a ham sandwich with mustard and mayonnaise every single day, and delivered mail. And then when he saw that he had precocious kids, took a second job. You know, but he couldn't express love, right, in a very outside of just being responsible. And so, like Jimmy, if you read Baldwin closely, he's very his judgment of his stepfather is exacting in the early days. You read Notes of a Native Son, I mean, it's devastating. But by the time you get to the latter years, Baldwin understands his father. So it's understands his stepfather much better. So it's it's a little bit of maturity. It's also growth in the relationship, being open to growing with someone. And now, you know, he's telling me what to say on television. It's hilarious.
There is that kind of, there's that conversation that a lot of men have with their fathers. It's this ideal to have somebody lead them as they grow older. And there's that gap. And then there's this kind of coming back together as they age. And it's usually through just life experiences or fatherhood, or to some sort of connection that that you then have with your father, because there are things that you're learning. I'm currently watching The Crown on Netflix, and it's just funny that we see these patterns and these tropes that just happen among men with Prince Philip and Prince Charles, and him wanting to go to a school that he went to, and like he's just frustrated at the fact that they're not as close, and he was sold by his uncle before that, you know, as he grows older and he becomes a father, he's gonna be seeking that forgiveness of being a father from Charles as well. But what lessons there did you learn about you becoming a parent yourself? And kind of, because there's this whole thing about, I wouldn't want to do the same things that my father kind of did to me. I don't want my children to fear me. I don't want my children to kind of dislike me. And when we then have kids, it becomes this next thing where I don't have children, but it's an anticipation for me, because I'm just like, oh, if I was to have children, would I want them to be scared of me? Am I going to carry on the same things that I've been taught? What were some of the lessons?
You know, oh, if my son could tell stories, if he ever writes a book. I mean, I had this ideal of what kind of father I was going to be. And but then I only had what I had. Mm-hmm. And I found myself sounding exactly like the man that I loathed. You know, I found myself duplicating the very things that he did in my own way, you know, even though I may be at the height of my career, you know, teaching at Princeton and all of this stuff. You know, I was raised a working class black man in the South, and trying to instill in my son what my father put in me, but he didn't do it right. You know, my brother and my sister and I, we always say that the world can't really shake us because we grew up in Eddie Glaude Sr.'s house. Right. So there's nothing really that the world can throw at us that's going to take us off our square. And my father used to say all the time, I'm not here to be your friend. I'm here to prepare you for the world that doesn't like you. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to give my son that kind of resolve. And it's very different because, you know, he was growing up in a you know, his godfather's Cornel West, and he's growing up in this environment where there are nothing but books and scholars and resources, right? But I found myself doing the exact same thing, you know, and horrified by what I was doing, and you know, telling him unlike my dad with me, telling him all the time that I loved him to death, but scaring him, you know? And we wrote a piece together for Time Magazine once. I wrote a piece. It was actually performed in Britain.
Okay.
And I wrote a piece responding to, you know, one of the police murders and worrying about him. And he responded and let me know that he had been listening. But it took a while, you know. It took a minute. So, you know, we're fallen, fragile creatures. And we fail, but, you know, like Samuel Beckett says, you know, fail, fail again, fail better. So.
Yeah. It's true. I think that heading into this conversation, I said, I love Baldwin. I think that in reading the book, Begin Again, I navigated some of the same things that you did, and there was things that I identified with when you spoke about not having really read him,
right?
Like, you were aware of who he was, right. And because the one thing I found about Baldwin before I sat down and read Go Tell It on the Mountain for the first time, I started really getting into African American literature, Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon, and then Go Tell It on the Mountain seemed like the sensible choice to come next. And I was frightened of him.
Yeah.
He had a power within him and the way that he writes. But I wanted to hear your story around your discovering him. Like, really discovering him and discovering his words in his text.
Yeah, you know, it was, you know, I had encountered Baldwin, obviously, in undergrad. I didn't read him when I was in high school. Yep. You know, I went to school. Mississippi's education system is one of the worst, if not the worst, in the United States. And I was in one of the worst school districts in the state of Mississippi. So I didn't encounter him until... seriously, I didn't encounter him until graduate school. And as I write in the book, I was hesitant because when, you know, Baldwin's prose, particularly his nonfiction, made everyone uncomfortable. And, you know, I had to confront, you know, flushed faces, red cheeks, you know, white guilt. And then I found myself having to navigate that in the seminar rooms. And I didn't want to do it. So I found myself in those early days gravitating to Ralph Ellison. So I was reading all of Ellison's nonfiction, you know, Shadow and Act and Going to the Territory and you know, writing my essays on Ellison because, as I write in the book, you know, his mask fit perfectly. There was an elegance to his pose. There was a kind of philosophical rigor to the essay. Baldwin's was scorched earth. Right? It was Jeremiah. It's just kind of this prophetic voice. And so it wasn't really until the last, my last years in graduate school and my first year of teaching, I taught The Fire Next Time. And my God, having to teach it and teaching it, you know, I would teach it right after teaching Toni Morrison's Beloved. Okay. And I would do that because Toni said, you know, in her eulogy with regard, you know, eulogy of Baldwin, that she found language in Baldwin's prose. So I was reading Jimmy differently, and then to have to teach him to students and so sitting in the language, and then boom, from that moment on, you know, it's almost 30 years ago, from that moment on, I taught Baldwin every year. Mm-hmm. And then I started pairing, you know, Fire Next Time with No Name in the Street. A book that folks don't typically read. And, oh my goodness.
Is that his last book?
Yeah, it's not the last book. It's, you know, the last book is The Evidence of Things Not Seen, right, which is about the Atlanta child murders. But this is a book published in 1972, and that book is the spine of Begin Again. It's the first book published after Dr. King's murder. And so it was that encounter in the classroom of having to expose students to the depth of Baldwin's prose, not to get beyond just simply the emotional and visceral reaction, but but to see what is he doing with the genre of the essay. How do we understand these sentences? What is the relationship between the way in which he's crafting this sentence and how he's reading Henry James? What is the way in which the King James Bible is informing this? How is this in the tradition of Emerson? In other words, I started delving into Baldwin's bibliography in order to understand him. And boom, the world opened up, right? It wasn't just Jeremiah. It was so much more. And I've been reading him. I've been an avid Baldwin reader ever since, you know, an avid Baldwin reader.
I actually don't like this question I'm going to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So what's your favorite Baldwin piece of work?
Oh, Lord.
Here's a word from our partners this year. This year, my intention was to work closely with businesses who were doing their very best to enhance our wellness and keep us in the best shape, especially since we are in this damn lockdown again. When I endeavored to find some, I didn't have to look too far, as they'd been around me for a very long time. So, the first sponsor I want to introduce is Herbie Box. I am a tea fiend. I'm currently drinking one of their teas right now, and I love tea, and I love herbal teas. So the guys over at Herbie Box have shared with me a discount code for you, Time to Talk listeners, to get 10% off of your one-time purchases on their two boxes, Immune and Athene. So a brief bit about their Immune Box. So Immune is their signature 7-day booster herbal blend. It nourishes the body, promotes calm, and helps increase the body's natural defenses. So if you love aromatic tasting teas, this blend is for you. Find out why so many Immune reviews mention more energy, more sleep, more calm, better digestion, and general feelings of well-being. Their Athene box is for the brain. So this one is a lot more to do with focus, to do with energy, to do with power, to do with mood. And it just gives you a bit more sharpness and a way to relax. So these are some of the reasons why people love Athene as well. It kind of gives them an energy boost. They are specially crafted herb vials, which you get 7 in a box. And Herbie Box have created this community event called a Herbie Week, where you take the 7 herbs in the vial and you just drink them throughout the week. And it's a way to reset and rejuvenate the body outside of the month, because, you know, a lot of the time we forget about what we're ingesting. And a lot of the stress that we have, we kind of put away, and it kind of goes into different parts of the body. So it's good to have something that helps heal the inside as well as us kind of focusing on our external. Especially in this new year, everyone's going to be wanting to get fit, get better, do all that stuff. But we need to really focus on what's going inside us. Okay, so if you want 10% off of your one-time purchase at Herbie Box, head over to herbiebox.com. That's herbybox.com. And at checkout, use discount code AlexHolmes10. So that's AlexHolmes10. And tell them I sent you. And trust me, you won't go wrong with your 7-day herbal blend. This episode is also brought to you by Beardfluence. All right, so we are in a lockdown, but your beard doesn't have to be. More time, I have been looking patchy, especially in the very first lockdown that we had last year. But this doesn't have to be the fate of your lockdown buddy, your male friend, or family member, as Beardfluence is offering you 15% off site-wide when you use the code TIMETOTALK2021. So that's TIMETOTALK2021. That's 15% off of their Kensington set, which is inclusive of a boar bristle brush, comb, and scissors. Everything comes gift wrapped as a gift to yourself or to someone else. And a little bit about Beardfluence is that it's a high performance beard care brand focused on targeted treatments such as promoting better growth and helping conditioning. Their flagship product is the Beardfluence Night Oil, and is powered by the scent of sandalwood, growth promoting castor and peppermint oil, and the hemp seed oil, which helps resolve beard itching. So all you have to do is go to their Instagram at BeardFluenceHQ and have a look at the rave reviews to know that it is good for you, your man, and your entanglement. But we don't promote entanglements on this show. We don't do that. So what I'm going to say is that you have to get detangled, and get detangled with BeardFluence. Let them know I sent you. So let's get on with the show. I actually don't like this question I'm going to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So what's your favorite Baldwin piece of work?
Oh, Lord. It all depends on which day you ask me, right? It all depends on which day you ask me. Today it will be No Name in the Street.
No Name in the Street. Okay. I've been meditating on The Fire Next Time, and I was meditating on The Fire Next Time for the whole of 2020. And it seemed like a fitting time to have The Fire Next Time with us. Where are we at with regards to kind of what Baldwin was saying in The Fire Next Time? How do we begin again with regards to what you're saying?
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's this line that in The Fire Next Time that is at, in some ways at the core of one of the arguments in Begin Again. And he says, and I'll read the passage, "The American Negro has the great advantage of having never believed that collection of myths to which white Americans cling, that their ancestors were all freedom-loving heroes, that they were born in the greatest country the world has ever seen, or that Americans are invincible in battle and wise in peace, that Americans have always dealt honorably with Mexicans and Indians and all other neighbors or inferiors, that American men and all, you know, are the world's most direct and virile, that American women are pure. Negroes know far more about white Americans than that. It can almost be said, in fact, that they know about white Americans what parents know about their children, and that they very often regard white Americans that way." So this passage is in some ways the key to how I think about the lie, right? Mm. That the lie has been at the heart of America's self-conception. This has been at the heart of the West's self-conception in some ways, right? And so part of what I think where we are now is this refusal to confront it. And in the United States, as well as in the UK, right, there's a reassertion of the lie in the face of, right, fundamental changes in how the society functions, right? We have these demographic shifts in the United States that fundamentally challenge this conception that America is a white nation in the vein of old Europe. And then there's this sense in which, you know, there's this romance, this nostalgic longing for a Britain of old. And you know what that means in its details, right? And so part of what I think Baldwin insisted upon is this kind of refusal of the safety of so-called innocence. Innocence for Baldwin is, you know, to be stuck in perpetual innocence is dangerous, right? It actually makes you monstrous. And so he says, if we're to be mature, we have to be honest with ourselves. We have to look the ghastliness of our failures in the face. That opens up the space for us to be otherwise. Just as I had to be honest with the wound in me in order to get to the page, just as my father and I had to be honest about the brokenness between the two of us in order to open up the possibility for us to be otherwise, these countries, the West, has to be honest about itself, to stop lying about what it has done and what it continues to do in the name of its so-called freedoms, in the name of its so-called commitments, and really open up the space for it to be otherwise. And that's Jimmy's honesty, man, his insightful vision. It's not burdened with any kind of, you know, ideology in any thick sense. It is the sound of an artist, of a prophetic witness. So, yeah, that's what I take to be the lesson.
Talk to me some more about honesty. How do we get to a point where we can readily share these honest truths about ourselves and our histories and where we're at?
Well, you know, in our intimate relationships, it requires, you know, a sense of trust, a willingness to be vulnerable with another, right? To tell the truth, you know? Sometimes you got to lie, though. We got to be clear about that. There's this wonderful, there's this extraordinarily powerful exchange between Baldwin and Nikki Giovanni that circulates on YouTube. And Nikki Giovanni is like, you know, you go out and lie to the man and then you come home and you beat up on me. Lie to me. And Baldwin is confused.
Yep.
He doesn't know what to do, how to respond to it. I can't lie to you, he says. But, you know, sometimes we have to, in the name of love, not reveal some of the things that we do. But that's a different sort of issue. I think the question that you're asking is a very, very insightful one. And that is a penetrating question. Sometimes the preconditions for honesty is trust. Sometimes the precondition for honesty is our own liberation. You know, Black folk in the United States, I can't speak to the particulars of Britain, but Black folk in the United States often find ourselves wearing the mask, not being honest, because we know what it would trigger. And in doing so, we become complicit, right, in the very arrangements themselves. So we just got to tell the truth about this. We can't dance any longer. And so that doesn't require trust. That just requires a faith in ourselves, in our own voice. So if we embrace a notion of our own self-determination, of our own freedom, we have to tell the truth about the hell we're catching. We can't dance around it. Mm. So, you know, those two different ways in which being honest can manifest itself, right?
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
So that does make sense. And I want to go two different ways with this. And so but the first way I'm going to go is your position as an academic. It's somebody who kind of is confronting a lot of these truths, mm. and doing that. Like, how difficult or easy was it to become more and more honest with what you're seeing, and then translating that as a way of teaching and enlightening your students and the people around you?
You know, it's an interesting question. I'm a student of Cornel West. He was my dissertation advisor along with Jeffrey Stout and Albert Raboteau. Right, okay. And, you know, he was a model for me.
Of course.
I come out of my political lineage. I come out of a Black nationalist tradition. Mm-hmm. Right. So there's always been this sense of a deep-seated skepticism about the American project that has been tempered over the years as I've gotten older. But I think at the heart of the answer to the question is a refusal. I refuse to take the bribe. And the bribe is this, it seems to me, and that is a kind of a temptation to just assume a level of comfort within the current set of arrangements. So if I'm a scholar, I could just simply write about, obscure professional things and teach these obscure professional things to my students and be rewarded for excellence in that area.
Yeah.
You know, but I decided to imagine myself in broader, more expansive terms. And so that called into question, right, whether or not I would be, you know, how does one get tenure? How does one acquire these platforms in order to say these sorts of things that one says? And I've just resisted over the course of my career the temptation to just simply reconcile myself to the status quo and combine that with an absolute love for ideas, and a bit of luck and grace. Mm-hmm.
I did want to push on the conversation of the Nikki Giovanni, and I'm so happy that you brought that up because I completely forgot about that. I remember reading it before I even watch or hear any a lot of these things. I'm reading them, so right. I bought the last interview collection, and it had him speaking with Nikki Giovanni, right. And I remember reading that when I was 23. I was like, okay. But again, it's like as you said earlier about reading things closely, and as you grow older and you start read it closely and you read it differently, you're like, oh. I hear you saying. Yeah. Then it went out of my mind, and then I found that there were the videos on YouTube, and then they had to kind of they started circulating, especially last year. They were circulating a lot. Lie to me. when you come home. What pressure do we have to be under in order for us to come home and be so honest, but also wanting to lie or needing to lie in order to protect the people around us?
You know, I wish I had the answer, you know, and one of the dangers of, you know, of this business is, you know, the presumption that, you know these things, right? Mm-hmm. And so what I do know is that human beings, particularly black human beings, people who inhabit these particular sorts of bodies, that we catch hell out here. That even when we are at the height of our professions, we're still catching hell out here. Yep. And trying to hold ourselves together to avoid, you know, the anger just, you know, seeping outside of the lid, you know, the rage evidencing itself. We're constantly engaging in this work to manage the volatile emotions that are part of what it means to navigate the world, a world that is organized in such a way that disregards us. And so there's a sense in which you can bring that shit home. And you can cause damage. I can imagine my father, going back to where we began. He's 21 years old with 4 kids, trying to figure out how he's going to put food on the table. Second African-American hired at the post office in Pascagoula, Mississippi, and having to deal with white folks who don't think he's competent. And my father has an extraordinary temper. And trying to make daily decisions, do I go to jail today and leave my children starving? Or do I suck this up? And then he comes home and he's silent. Doesn't say a word. That's one of the strangest elements of my memory of my childhood, is how quiet the house was. And then how volatile it would become. Right? He would go from, you know, silence to a kind of scream that would, you know, make you shudder on the inside. So what does it mean then to be able to be vulnerable enough when you come home in the face of what you've just experienced, and to be vulnerable enough in such a way that you're attentive to the other person in your life? Because in some ways, that's what Nikki Giovanni is trying to say to Jimmy at that moment. When you read Baldwin's letters, for example, to his brother David, Ed Pavlik has this wonderful new book, if it ever gets published, about the letters between the two brothers, and David is Baldwin's closest friend. But when you read the letters, you long, Alex, for David's voice. Because Baldwin is just asking, pulling. And you said, damn it, Baldwin seems so narcissistic that his demand for honesty oftentimes makes it feel like, at least because you don't hear David's voice, makes you feel like Baldwin is just concerned about himself, that he's not thinking about mom, his mother. He's not thinking about, although he was, right, this sort of thing. So when Nikki Giovanni says to Jimmy, lie to me, she's like, be concerned about me. You can't tell me that. You can't. Why would you do that? What are you doing? Why would you break my heart in that way? Sometimes when you love someone deeply, right, it is out of that love that you don't expose them to the monstrosity that you are. I know that sounds crazy, but I think that's true.
Absolutely not crazy at all. Absolutely not crazy at all. And I get that. When we think of Baldwin, because I remember, because even looking at that, watching that, I think I'm just visually back watching that now. And I remember his face was like, what do you mean? Like,
I can't lie to you.
I can't lie to you. And because his whole, if we're talking in 2021, 2020 terms, his whole brand was honesty. Like, everywhere, every interview, every word he placed was a scathing revelation on, like, the realities of life. and his own experience. Like, I would be frightened to sit down in front of him and say, lie to me, Jimmy. I'll be scared myself. I'll be frightened. So to see his face kind of like in that shock of like him asking, what do you mean? That level of vulnerability was powerful, because it was like,
yeah,
you know, he went back after and was like, wow, actually.
Yeah. And the thing is that it shows you the generosity of Baldwin too. You know, Nikki Giovanni was an up and coming poet at the time. And here's Baldwin, this giant, and he's listening, he's taking it in. And let me be clear. Baldwin is not, I don't think Nikki Giovanni is actually asking him to lie to her about who he is. Mm. That's not what we mean. We do monstrous things, even though we're not monsters. We can do monstrous things. And so what she's saying to him is that Black women have had to bear the burden of the hell that Black men catch in the world. You dance, you shuck and jive out there, and then you come and pop me upside my head. Throw me across the room. You're lying out there. You're wearing the mask out there. And then you come and take it out on me. Lie to me. And what she's saying to me is, at least how I'm reading that moment, is what does it mean to keep me in view, to bring me into view? And that is not to say, not just simply to be so consumed with your pain that then I have to bear the burden of it. But what does it mean in relation to your pain to keep me in view, to keep the people you love in view? Then maybe, you know, Daddy wouldn't have been so harsh with us, you know, if he kept. So even in the midst of the hustle, of the grind, right, you got what that love requires of you, it seems to me, is an ongoing attentiveness, an ongoing tending to those for whom you would give your life.
Yeah. What does it mean to you to be a good man? I've been reading a lot around masculinity and masculinities, and what you've said about, you know, you put your mask on out in the world and you come home and take it out. And a lot of men take it out on the women or the people they love in their homes. And as a Black man, as a man in general, how do we, like coming up, myself coming up into the world and kind of building a platform and a voice for myself in this space, and how do we genuinely become good men?
You know, I've never been asked that question before. And my initial reaction is, you know, what it means to be a good man means what it, you know, is just another way of asking, what does it mean to be a decent and good person? Right? What does it mean to live a life that is animated by love, that's animated by responsibility and decency, right? To leave behind, you know, all of these assumptions about what it means to be a man, right? That's that we can't show vulnerability, right? That, you know, how much gets lost because we can't cry. At least in a certain, under certain, you know, how much gets lost when we have to assume that the burden must rest on our shoulders alone. What are the cost of a certain kind of hyper-masculine pose? Right, so for me, what does it mean to be a good man is a question that I would throw, that I would have to revise. What does it mean to be a decent human being?
Mm.
Right. And I think that has everything to do with living a life of love, right? Being responsible to yourself and to others. And a willingness, I think, a willingness to confront the fact that, you know, we're all broken, fragile, you know, fallen, vulnerable creatures. Or to put it as my mother would put it on the coast of Mississippi, this working class Black woman, to realize that my shit stank just like everybody else's. to put it, Jessica. You can edit that out, I suppose.
Yeah. No, wait, no, that will stay. I asked because I recently read a piece that my friend sent me, and it was kind of looking at the status of the good man. And it used Barack Obama as a critical experience in the piece. It was talking about how he upheld capitalistic and patriarchal identity and views, and you know, and a lot of the conversations we have around being good men tend to exclude, you know, queer men. Mm-hmm. It really excludes trans men. It excludes the non-binary, and it also excludes the responsibility to protecting women and children. Mm-hmm. And it did make me think a lot about where that whole idea comes from, and if we're kind of relating it back to James Baldwin, when we have him here as a prolific speaker, writer, voice of the time, and then we have him next to, when I'm reading, have him next to the Stokely Carmichael and the Kwame Toure's, the Malcolm X's, his friends, the Elijah Muhammad's, the Martin Luther King's, it somehow feels as if he was on a back foot, in a sense, because of his sexuality and because of that. It feels like yes, he had validity and he had kind of like assertion and he had the energy that went with him. But there was just something.
Yeah.
That was just like, wait a minute. So, you know, am I making sense?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. All right, okay. When I interviewed Angela Davis for the book, she talked about how many times Baldwin was out there all by himself. I mean, just think about it, man. You publish your first novel, it's Go Tell It on the Mountain, and you know the publishing industry is just very clear. You know, you hit with that one, you're gonna write another one that is probably in the same vault. They want to box you in, and then Baldwin drops Giovanni's Room, right? A book that people say is about same-sex love, and Jimmy says it's about love. It just happens to be between two, right? It's about love, right? Two men, right? So what Baldwin, and then Baldwin says, you know, you can't hold my sexuality over my head. I told you, right? So he's out there all by himself in so many ways, and Angela Davis was saying this as a queer woman, right? Who experienced what she experienced. And witnessed Baldwin, right, in this way. But, you know, there's this, you know, Bayard, someone just yesterday sent me an email asking me about King's response to Jimmy as opposed to Bayard Rustin, who was also queer or gay. Mm. And I was like, the fact is that Baldwin was out, you know, he wasn't closeted, you know. He resisted these categories that tried to box him in some ways, he, you know, calling him gay or queer isn't quite right. You know, our language of non-binary, what are his pronouns? You know, I think we have a language that Baldwin was always already pointing us toward now. He was trying to inhabit that then. But then at the same time, Alex, you know, there's this story. He's at this Black Panther event in California. And, you know, somebody's doing some gunplay and then they have an epileptic fit. They have a seizure, and the guy starts shooting. And Betty Shabazz is there with her children on stage. And when the gunshots ring out, everybody runs. But, you know, Baldwin, who's so fragile, and you know, screams, "The babies!" And he runs and covers them. So in the midst of this hyper-masculine performance, when gunshots ring and people break, what does Baldwin do? Goes and puts his body over those babies, man. So I think you're absolutely right that he stands he's constantly queering Black politics. He's constantly, right, queering a certain notion of Black masculinity. He is always misfitted. And it's from that perch that he offers the most searing criticism of the West, it seems to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. It's true. But that's really interesting about, you know, about saving the babies.
Yeah.
Because it's those kind of actions that people hold high, but they don't necessarily, we don't necessarily bear witness to those things, you know? It's like, yes, like we could talk about, yes, he went and, you know, he went to protect the children, and like that was such an amazing, caring man. But in the moment, that's not what the men do. And I this is where, when it comes to those questions,
yeah,
around being a good man, I'm just always looking at it and just thinking, this blueprint that we've been given to be men, you know, from me coming up from 1991 to now, and just like looking at it and thinking, wait, none of this makes, this does, so yeah, most of this stuff does not fit. So yeah, I look to people like yourself and to Baldwin and to the writers before me, and a lot of those people, and I see that there are there, but they're just so few in the main, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important that maybe we might need to change the noun in the question.
Right.
It's not that what does it mean to be good men, but what does it mean to be good?
Good. Be good people.
Yeah. Period. You know.
So, tell me about going to see his home. That was actually, yeah. Tell me about going to see his home. That whole experience was dope.
But I was in Heidelberg, and you know,
yeah. I was in Germany, right?
Yeah, yeah, I was in Heidelberg, Germany, and I took a flight to Nice, and it's supposed to be like a day, you know, an overnight trip, and so I was going to fly into Nice, and I was just going to go catch a cab and go into St. Paul de Vence and just see it, because I knew they were tearing it down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't know that there was this national dance party that France has. And, you know, I was like, what the hell is this? And this guy who was my taxi driver, I told him that, you know, what I was doing, and, you know, he wanted to practice his English with me, I suppose. And I said, you know, I want to go to St. Paul de Vence. He said, you must go now. Because France is going to be locked down, you know, and it was during the World Cup too. And that's the year that France won the World Cup. So everybody was like locked in. And so, when I saw it, you know, I was stunned. You know, it looked like an archaeological site. The portion of the house that was still there, the side of the wall was beaten by sun. There were plows and all sorts of construction equipment all around. And there was a sign that said, you know, this was going to be, you know, the site of luxury apartments with the panoramic view. Because just above my head was the city of St. Paul de Vence. It's a gorgeous spot. I could imagine Baldwin waking up after, you know, around 12 o'clock or 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon after a night of drinking and writing. Lighting a cigarette, pouring himself a cup of coffee, and looking out. I mean, it's stunning. But, you know, the idea that capitalism had got him, that the place that he called home, that the place that held the welcome table was now going to be the site of luxury, you know, condos. It was just this kind of sad moment. So I went back to Nice and drank myself into a stupor.
Yeah. Part of me just been really thinking about, when it comes to like these homes, how long they can be preserved in history until they just become a memory.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, I don't know whether it could have been passed down to anybody or anything, but when I saw that, I was like, oh, so I will never get to see it. Like, I will never get to see it. Like, I don't even know if we are going to go into a lockdown at this point in time in the UK. And at the point of when you went to see it, it was half, you know, demolished already.
They say they're going to keep that part of it, but I can only imagine what it will look like surrounded by all of these, these folk. And then, you know, they thought, you know, it was fascinating because my cab driver looked like he was, you know, this muscular guy from New Jersey, you know, South Jersey. And here I was in this kind of, you know, powder blue linen shirt and, you know, fitted jeans and white. And I think they thought we were initially a couple looking for property and whatnot. So, and then when I told them that I was a scholar working on Baldwin, they got all defensive and started defending what was going to be left over, you know, always defending the leftovers, you know?
Yeah. That must've been powerful though. Just to have been there. You spoke about, leaving home. You said you ran away. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you just about what it means to find home as a member of the displaced, I suppose. Your whole book is a conversation around confronting whiteness, I suppose. How do black people, I guess, how do the displaced find their homes in these spaces?
Yeah, you know, there's a chapter in the book entitled Elsewhere. And yes, the chapter initially wasn't going to be written because I had planned to go to Istanbul. I was going to retrace Jimmy's steps through Istanbul. Right. And, you know, I'm a television commentator in the United States, and people were like, have you lost your mind? You're a critic of Donald Trump, and you're going to go to Erdogan's Istanbul? Have you lost your mind? Yeah. And then there's this, you know, the State Department had issued a warning about travel to Istanbul, so I didn't go. So my editor was in the States, was asking me, well, why don't you write something, go interview activists? And I said, well, no, we're always extracting things from them.
Yeah.
Can I write something for them? That's what I want to do. And elsewhere is this notion that we all must find our elsewhere so that we can replenish those spaces that allow us to laugh full belly laughs, those communities that allow us to rage,
yeah,
those spaces and relationships that when our knees buckle, they got our backs. Right. So there's this moment in From Another Place, this gorgeous short film of Baldwin in Istanbul, where he's standing on the balcony and he looks back and he's puzzled. And then he breaks out into this extraordinary smile, full tooth smile. And I was like, that's it. That's the kind of space where I can be fully myself, where people aren't taken with, you know, who you are or who you take yourself to be, but they will tell you the truth. So elsewhere is this space that allows us to be comfortable in our skin. And Jimmy found that in communities across the globe. He called himself a transatlantic commuter. He knew he was tethered to this place, to the United States, but mm-hmm. he found this space where people around him allowed him to, no, let me put it differently. The people around him loved him enough so that he could feel at home. And I think that's what home really is, really. You know, I think when I think about it, you know, that space that affirms and confirms us in all of our complexity. And then when we enter it, we can exhale. And then when we leave it, you know, we're ready to tackle the world, you know?
So as black people then, or as people that are displaced, you've, in the United States, you're edging out of a presidency that wasn't the best.
to put it lightly.
The idea of home for a lot of Americans was split straight down the middle. Mm. It doesn't feel safe, especially with COVID as well. Like nobody knows whether they're coming or going or anything. And what is the overall mood and sense like since Trump's loss? And Where are you at with that?
Well, the country's broken, man. It's so it's so clear. America is broken. We're experiencing, in some light, the last days of the American empire. It's collapsing right in front of our faces. There are those with 4 years of evidence of mendacity, of incompetence, of corruption and greed. Close to 75 million Americans voted for him with that evidence. It gives you a sense of the state of the polity. We're divided, rural, urban, Republican, Democrat, black, white. The divisions map onto disputes that go all the way back to the Civil War that were never resolved. We're on a knife's edge as a country in the midst of a pandemic where liberty has become a synonym for selfishness. Right? I mean, that's, you know, today when we're talking right now, 340 plus thousand Americans are dead. Projecting out by the end of February, close to half a million Americans will be dead. And we need to be clear, the majority of them are poor and black and brown. Poor. So it seems to me that, you know, as the late Stuart Hall put it, you know, all crises moments are conjunctural moments, right? There are moments of crises and possibility. So the collapse in this moment affords us an opportunity to imagine ourselves otherwise. The question is, will these folk have the courage to do so? That's the question.
At some point, I'm going to have a conversation with somebody around the state of politics in America, because it's a lot, and I'm just very like concerned for the space that we're holding right now. Yeah. But how will that status quo change? There's that question. And then there's also this next just point that's just come to my mind. And it's, I watch a lot of historical dramas. I watch a lot of periodic dramas and things. And I watch a lot of, you know, I tapping back into the Kennedys, tapping back into kind of like the 50s or 40s or whatever, the booming 20s, all of this stuff.
Mm.
I look into all of that stuff and I can't help but feel this feeling of it's not nostalgia because I don't long for it, but it's a slight fear. Like I watched Ma Rainey's Black Bottom
mm-hmm.
the other day, and while I watched it and I watched the success of, like, you know, the kind of presence that Ma Rainey held. And August Wilson was very big on creating those kind of plays that centered the Black African American experience, as you well know. And I was watching, I was like, "Yeah, this is amazing to see." You know, she's commanding things in her own right. She's this person inside the studio. As soon as she steps out of the studio, she's just another black woman who is of no consequence. And the black men in there was the whole scene around the lynching and about talking about lynching and whatnot.
Mm.
Whenever I watch these shows, I watch these things, I feel this overwhelming sadness. That's the word. It's a sadness of, if I was to go back in time and stand and just bear witness to any of this, I would probably be killed. in a way, you know,
mm-hmm.
or a whole demographic of people that look like me would be put into a situation that really belittled their human rights. So how do we change the status quo? What do you see for the future? Because sometimes with black people, we can only look to the future because the past was so awful.
Yeah, you know, look, I mean, so there's a certain kind of Afro-pessimist view about the world that makes it necessary, almost You can't imagine the world being different, so you have to go become an Afrofuturist in some ways. You have to step outside of the world as it is, because the world will always be, you know, anti-Black in some ways. I don't hold that view. I think that, you know, history is replete with examples of the horror you just laid out, but it's also replete with example of extraordinary courage in the face of those horrors. And what I do know is that when everyday ordinary people muster the energy and courage to clap back, to organize, to leave behind the bribe, and to imagine what Jimmy would call a New Jerusalem, we could do that, right? I mean, it's no guarantee of success, but, you know, my faith is in us, you know. Baldwin said in response to the murder of Dr. King that and he collapsed in some ways, had to figure out how to pick himself back up after King's assassination. He was like, what does it mean that the country killed him, you know? But he says, you know, he learned something, that human beings were at once miracles and disasters, that you had to protect yourself from the disasters that we've become, right? But understanding that we can be miracles too. So the answer to your question is, how do we change the status quo, right? Well, we change the status quo by organizing for a better world, right? By engaging in the hard work of politics, which means that we need to build solidarities with other groups who are marginalized. We need to put forward values that reflect the dignity and standing of every human being, no matter the color of their skin, no matter who they love, no matter their gender, no matter their zip code, where they live, right? What kind of work they do, right? We need to argue for that world. We need to fight for that world. It's not just going to happen. It's not just going to drop out of the sky. So, you know, it is certainly the case that history is replete with evil. It is clear. It is replete with examples of folk who do evil. But it's also replete with examples of folk who muster the courage in the face of it. So all we have, unless we resign ourselves to a kind of pessimistic view that will then justify you taking the bribe. Because some people will say, well, the world can't change, so I might as well get mine. And some people have done it. No. How do we change the status quo? We fight our asses off for a better world. We risk everything for a better world. We bear witness until the day we die, until the day we take our last breath. See, this is the thing. The Baldwin I write about in Begin Again is the Baldwin that most people didn't want to hear. Baldwin, the late Baldwin, is at the heart of Begin Again. And the late Baldwin is the Baldwin who's still writing in the age of the Cosby Show. He's still writing when Black middle-class folk are compromising with Bill Clinton, and they're beginning to gain entree into seats of power at different levels, and Baldwin is still bringing critique to bear. When the evidence of things not seen, he's like, what does it mean that these Black babies have been murdered in Atlanta when all these Black people hold power? And he's writing it in a moment that if you just fast forward and you think about that moment when Barack Obama calls these folk in Baltimore thugs, and you have the picture of him calling them thugs at the same time that you have them in the streets, right, rioting, quote unquote, right, in Baltimore after the death, the murder of Freddie Gray. That contrast, that contradiction, Baldwin was thinking about it in 87. When the evidence of things not seen was published. So the short answer, I haven't been giving you short answers, Alex, but the short answer is very clear. We risk everything. That's how we change the status quo. We don't become adjusted to injustice. We must remain maladjusted to it always, and then fight for a better world.
Amazing. What makes us What makes us more compassionate?
Love. Love, it seems to me. And I don't mean sentimental love, right? I mean something much more complex, right? In all of the Greek senses of love, that's what I mean.
All of them.
All of them. not one of them, not agape, not just simply agape, not just simply philia, mm-hmm. eros, all of them matter.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So who's the person you turn to in the heights of your vulnerable moments?
I don't know. Sometimes it's my wife. Sometimes it's Cornel West. Most of the time it's my mama. I'm a mama's boy. she constitutes the center of gravity for me. So when I feel like I'm losing my way, I talk to her, and she recalibrates everything. But there's a kind of deep-seated loneliness that's attached to this stuff, to this work. And so in those desperate moments, oftentimes you find yourself alone because you want to protect the folks around you because they start worrying about you and you don't want them to worry.
Yeah. So some final questions before we round up. We've been speaking for what feels like 10 minutes,
but it's been
over an hour. Name some of the books that you've gifted the most.
Oh, wow. Some of the books that I've gifted the most. Well, obviously, The Fire Next Time.
Yeah.
But, you know, the library edition of Baldwin's Collected Nonfiction, Library of America edition, is just great. Toni Morrison's Beloved. Mm-hmm. As of late, I've been giving Imani Perry's Breathe, A Letter to My Sons. Natasha Trethewey's memoir, it's just brilliant, titled Memorial Drive.
Okay.
Sarah Broom's The Yellow House, a memoir about her time in New Orleans. And then every now and then I'll throw some Chekhov or some Faulkner in there.
Final question: do you have like a daily mantra or quote or routine that you can that shakes you, that gets you kind of either invigorated or calmed or, as you said, recalibrated?
You know, it's not daily, but I say it to myself regularly, and that is: the world conspires to make you small. The question is, will you be complicit? You know, the world conspires to make you small. And the question is whether or not you will be complicit, Eddie. Walk with giant steps. And then I usually put on Coltrane's Giant Steps.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Eddie, for joining me today. It's been an amazing conversation.
It's my pleasure, man. I appreciate you. And stay strong.
You too. Thank you. Thank you so much to Eddie Esclau Jr. Thank you for joining me on the show. Thank you for listening, and don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Remember, you can find Begin Again under the link in the description, and you can get the book from ukbookshops.org. And make sure that you share, rate, review, and subscribe. And again, this show was produced and edited by Ryan Nile over at Pure Creation Media. If you want to head over to his Instagram, it will be in my show notes. A huge thank you to him. And thank you to you just for listening. And make sure that you connect with me. Share anything that you want to hear, anything you want to know. Just drop me a message. Also, don't forget, if you want to become a member of my Patreon-like membership program, make sure you click the link in the description and you get a list of goodies. There are so many things coming this year, towards the end of the year. So I'm just trying to prime you guys for that stuff. So thank you so much for being here. I appreciate you all. Take care of yourselves. Take care of yourselves.